proceed.
Again, welcome to Philadelphia and ULT. As is our custom, we familiarize you with the declaration, which you should pick up a copy before you leave if you don't have one. On the back, you'll see that this is an international organization, several lodges located all over the world. The main topic this morning will be the declaration, but also there will be a short essay on our program during the week. Now, the declaration, please listen. That the policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a true realization of the self, a profound conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim and purpose and teaching. Therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers. The sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. And for that purpose, we carry on here two meetings per week. As you see, on Sunday mornings, the doors opened at 10:30 and began promptly at 11. The topic for today, November the 27th, the potential for human perfectibility. On Wednesday nights, we have study classes. At the present time, we're studying in that wonderful volume, The Key to the Theosophy by H.P. Blavatsky. And everyone is welcome to that class. Now, the doors open at 5:15 so that you can come in and visit our library until 7:15. It's a reference library, and it's always a volunteer there to help you select the topics you wish to read about, including tonight's topic, or Wednesday night, the potential for human perfectibility. Now, these classes are open to everyone, students and visitors alike. Now, there may be a few other ideas or questions you have. When we let out today, just stop at the book table and there'll be a volunteer there to answer your questions. We carried this little thing folded up in our pockets, we don't know how long. But generally when you're riding a bus or somewhere, have a minute, take a peek at it and you'll be surprised how much more comes out of it than what you've just heard. As is our custom, there will be a reading from the Bhagavad Gita now. And it's from the second chapter. And Krishna his speaking. A man is said to be confirmed in spiritual knowledge when he forsaketh every desire which entereth into his heart, and of himself is happy and content in the self, through the self. His mind is undisturbed in adversity, he is happy and contented in prosperity, and he's a stranger to anxiety, fear, and anger. Such a man is called a Muni, a wise man. When in every condition he receives each event, whether favorable or unfavorable, with an equal mind, with neither likes nor dislikes, his wisdom is established. And having met good or evil, neither rejoices at the one nor is cast down by the other. He is confirmed in spiritual knowledge when, like the tortoise, he can draw in all his senses and restrain them from their wanted purposes. The hungry man loses sight of every other object but the gratification of his appetite. When he's become acquainted with the Supreme, he loses all taste for objects of whatever kind. The tumultuous senses and organs hurry away by force. The heart, even of the wise man, who striveth after perfection. Let a man, restraining all these, remain in devotion, at rest in me, his true self. For he who hath his senses and organs in control possesses spiritual knowledge.
The potential for human perfectibility. Well, that's at the heart of this philosophy. This is at the heart of this ancient wisdom, is that man is not only perfectible, but every atom in the universe is perfectible. That's the wider understanding. Everything is endowed with consciousness. And through law, harmony, attraction, each atom builds up in association with other atoms, and form is produced, and so on and so on and so on. Life is a cooperation. It is a gentle moving forward in time and space. And we're on this journey together. You know, we often forget. We say we are not these bodies. We are not these emotions. We are not what we see. But yet when we speak of others' shortcomings. We speak of our own shortcomings and our frailties and our weaknesses. Where in fact what we should be talking about is our spiritual nature, our oneness, our harmony, our cooperation. Those are the things we should be cooperating or should be considering together. And that's what we do each week. We consider those ideas of cooperation. But all of nature cooperates, and it is moving forward to this point of perfectibility. It is said that at the end of the great period of evolution, all the forms will have reached their pinnacle of perfectibility. Now, well, that's a blanket statement, but you know, everything is qualified. I just want to read a couple of statements from the Secret Doctrine to put our mind in focus. But I forgot my glasses. Well, let's see. I did forget my glasses, so I'll squint.
Do you need it there? Do you want us to get you one?
Yes, yeah, please, thank you. Oh, look at this. I hope everyone has the same astigmatism. Oh, well, thank you very much. It's covered. Thank you very much. I won't ask how I look because that would be personal. It doesn't matter, but thank you. In the Secret Doctrine, in the very beginning of it, it states, for every atom in the universe has the potentiality of self-consciousness. In it and is a universe in itself and for itself. It is an atom and an angel. And then she goes on to state later on, every form on earth and every atom in space strives in its effort towards self-fecundation to follow the model place for it in the heavenly man. It's the atom's involution and evolution, its external and internal growth and development have all one and the same object, man. Man as the highest physical and ultimate form on this earth. The monad, in its absolute totality and awakened condition, as the culmination of the divine incarnation on earth in this fourth round. And it stated that the beginning of the fourth round was the work of the formation of man. And now it is the reformation and the evolutionary perfection. So there's a purpose. The universe has a purpose. It is loving, it is kind, because it gives us what is just. So if we are perfectible, and we all sometimes don't want to hear that, because we've been told so long that we are imperfect, we are sinners, we need a priest, we are intermediary between us and God. There are just so many things that disconnected. But when we come to this philosophy, we see that we are perfectible. But how is that possible? Well, if one studies karma, one sees the responsibility that we have. Every thought, word, and deed is a cause. It has its effect. And everything that comes to us is ours. That's total responsibility. So therefore, if we say our actions were totally responsible, what about us? What about this very creature that we're using to communicate on this plane? Is that having relevance? Well, this is all the relevance. Our battles start right here, right within ourselves. That's the battle that we have to fight in this incarnation. We have to fight the battle of our senses that aren't real, but ever changing. We have to become the master of the house in which we live in. And we sort of laugh. The world in which we live is, we have no control. Like, it's, you know, we feel like lost when we look outside of ourselves. But that's only because We just need to look inside ourselves for the real conflict that is raging. It's between our personal and our impersonal selves, between the personality and the individuality. And we are all individual rays of that great sun. Every atom in the universe is a ray of that. But through eons of accumulated experience and contact with the material plane, it has moved forward, first by natural impulse. Everything is moving forward by a natural impulse. It's called instinct in the later stages, but it's, you see, in the mental kingdom, it's cohesive, it's binding together. The animal, the plant kingdom is sensitive, and it's sensitive to light, and the animal kingdom incorporates all of that in itself. But then the human kingdom is the blossom of this evolutionary process. And as once we reach the man stage, then we become responsible. And this is when we become as gods, because we are now able to choose. I can choose what I'm going to do. I can choose what I'm going to concentrate on. The soul itself is imbued with power, compassion, and knowledge. We know it. We fiddled it away in the mundane world. But if we use our willpower, we can conquer this raging fire within ourselves of our senses and our desires. The Gita, that is what the Gita talks about. It's nothing that, it's no great revelation. It just points out the way, points out our responsibility and how we can do it. Don't look for the results of your deeds. Do what needs to be done. Be single-minded. Be centered. Learn to concentrate. Learn to meditate. And act as if for all. You won't create any more karma. You'll begin living totally in the moment, which is the hardest thing to do. We do it in our jobs. We do it in our professional areas. We do it in our things that we love to do. Well, that's the same concentration. Same stuff, same concentration. We just need to arouse in ourselves the truth that we hear and we know, and to live that truth. Because we're living whatever, we're living a truth now that we think is true, but we're finding out it's not true. We're not poor, miserable sinners. We're not born into sin. The mind is beginning to open. Not until the next great round will it be fully opened. But we're coming to the close of the fourth round. Yeah, give or take a few million years, I guess. But it's beginning to open. And we see compassion blooming up in all directions. Sure, we see the other side of that as well. But it said, without passion, there is no compassion. That the world of opposites is important for the contrast. We need the contrast to know what is right and what is wrong. We don't know what good is until we know what bad is. We don't know what selfish truly means when we consider selfless, and even in between unselfish. These are all mental concentrations. That's putting your mind focused on the self. How you feel, but no, not so much how you feel. Are you one with yourself? Have you listened to your heart? Have they listened to your mind? Have you listened? And through this listening, we get to know ourself. And through concentration and meditation, we develop that faculty. It's nothing that you're going to say, poof, I've got it. No. None of us can ever stop. We are moving forward. Our mind is beginning to open. We are beginning to see the truth. And that is what materialism does not want us to see. We live in illusion, and that is what it is. And we make that illusion. The power that we have is in our speech. It's power. It awakens things in other people, or it puts them to sleep. But it is power. It's the expression of an idea in vibration. An idea is a vibration, but it's a much more subtle one. Thought is a vibration, but very subtle. Speech is the material expression of that vibration. And it is how, as a man, we can share our being, our very being, because we are all beings. And the idea of compassion, it's part of our being. Compassion is part of our being. Try to feel compassion. Try to understand what it is to be in someone else's shoes when they are suffering. Because woe unto thee who has not suffered. For that's how we gain compassion. But the one that is important as well is knowledge. And knowledge you must pursue. You must take responsibility for what you do, what you think, and what you say. Total responsibility. And there is knowledge. There is truth. Relative truth, but there is absolute truth. The absolute truth is how we need to live our lives. That's how you make theosophy a living power in your life. That's how you can perfect this form, but the ideas that we hold to be true, the idea of cooperation instead of competition, the idea of building someone else instead of trying to tear them down. Love ye one another. And it becomes that more difficult when you don't like that other. But that is the challenge. We are not these feelings. We are not these emotions. We are not these bodies. We are more than that. We are a divine light. Through eons of time, we have learned great knowledge, and we have it within us, but we have become so immersed in matter that we have identified with it. and have become ignorant of our true nature. So, to learn your true nature, you have to want to. You have to want to know who you are, and how that you never die. You are an eternal being. But we're here together in this speck of time. Just speck of time. Meaningless, but it has all the meaning to us. We are the creators, and we have the potential to become perfect. To become, because we are perfect. And it's letting go of those sheaths of ignorance or false ideas that we held to be true, that have bound us up and made us slaves. Man is meant to be free. The mind has to be free. Well, since this is the essence of theosophy, that's just a brief introduction to maybe getting you to consider this idea of perfectibility. And perhaps you may have some questions or comments or insight that you'd like to share. Yes.
You mentioned how even the atom is perfectible, and that is such an awesome concept, that the atom at some point in time can be perfectible. And that is, I mean, perfectibility is an idea that theosophy has that the other religions have lost over time, because essentially, they did believe in perfectibility, but all the trappings have hidden it. But it is that, I mean, when the talk expressed that about the atom, it was, oh my goodness, that's an, you know, it's an incredible idea.
Well, the idea is a universal idea. It not only pertains to us, but we are the culmination of this evolutionary process. So it's quite meaningful that man is perfectible, because it says all of life is perfectible. But perfectibility is relative. It's relative. It's relative to this period of evolution. You think it all stops? No. We're eternal. We go from one consciousness to another. To learn and to understand our true godlike qualities. But that doesn't mean that I'm God. No, it means that we are all one. That we are all one. We are not separate from each other. And that is a fundamental law of the universe, is unity. Unity. Yes?
Well, we've heard the terminology, chip on the shoulder. And we pick up the newspaper today and we see so much evidence of the chip on the shoulder. I dare you to knock the chip on my shoulder, whatever it is. How can we help nature when we ourselves have chips on the shoulder?
Well,
how do we determine where those chips come from and what we should do about them?
Well, if we don't have a chip on the shoulder, we have a bad attitude, or we have a we're grumpy, or something. We're not perfect. None of us are perfect. But our yoga is we need to be watchful. of this body that we occupy and what it does. Was that just a spontaneous reaction? No thought involved? And we just did it? And we're going, why did I do that? But it seems to be our response to those kind of situations we see as we look. So, this is our laboratory, this life, this moment, because we're in control of this moment. How we react to the moment, how we are involved in the moment, how we are adding to the moment or taking away from the moment. What are we doing in this moment? Are we generating the thoughts for all of us? Are we stimulating ourselves to think? Are we stimulating our curiosity to know the truth that we've lived with for so long that we thought was true?
We often hold to that term, pointing out the way. And these meetings and these textbooks are really psychology. But that word doesn't fit the picture. These are not out. But at least we learn to study ourselves and gain self-control. But does theosophy give us some idea where we can begin to look for the enemy within our own selves rather than outside?
Well, there is a psychology that we can follow. It's called the Bhagavad Gita. It points out the path and shows you how to walk it, or tells you how to walk it. And it's really an attitude of mind that one must develop. I think what happens when we come in these rooms is that we question all those things that we thought were true before, and now we're presented with a different paradigm. So it's like anything else, it has to be absorbed. Consider it, absorb it. And lo and behold, it begins to filter through our thinking, and we begin to consider it in all areas of our life. That's the process. Step by step. In the back.
When we first read these ideas in theosophy, we decided we couldn't possibly ever be perfectible because there were a lot of people we didn't like and it didn't look like we were going to change our mind. And an older student said, nobody's asking you to like everybody, but you have to treat everyone equally. So you have to treat the people you don't like exactly as you treat the people you do like. And we think that's the best advice we were ever given.
Yes, and but again, we need not focus on that which is selfish in ourselves, that which is some call evil, or our shortcomings. We need to build upon our spiritual natures. Yes?
In the opening reading from the Bhagavad Gita, it said you must lose all taste for desires of all sorts. Wouldn't that also entail losing the desire to become a better human being?
Well, the desire to become a better human being. Well, that may be a way of saying a lot of things. You know, why do we want to become a better human being? That's the real question. And we can do many things, but when we work for others, and unselfishly and sacrifice, even though we may not have the greatest knowledge, that is what is our salvation. We live a life of compassion, and we serve others in whatever way we can. A friendly smile, a helping hand, you know. Let someone go in front of you, whatever, whatever. That you're just there to help. You're not in a hurry. Everybody's in a hurry. You can't be in a hurry, because that moment goes like that. And you're not thinking of now, you're thinking of, okay, I'm home, you know, you're not in the moment. You're thinking, you're somewhere else. So the Gita constantly reminds us that we are soul beings and that we need to act as soul beings and give up this personal attachments. We are not these feelings. The feelings are a principle in themselves. It's one of the principles of man or of the universe, is karma. And it's translated in many ways. But lust and greed, and I mean, that's an emotion. It's an entity. And the only way that we manifest these things, if we let that emotion, that being enter us. Jealousy, rage, anger. Like we lose it. Yeah, because we've invited somebody in to take over. What, let's see how crazy we can get this time. You know, it's we turn ourselves over to that emotion. And that's, and you see so many young people doing that. But it's not their emotion, it's there. They are attracting it to themselves. Yes.
Well, if we have a desire to be a better human being, and that is in the forefront, and that's a very personal emotion, because we're always weighing everything, it becomes like, well, how am I going to look good? How am I going to... If we just do what's in front of us and not think about, I'm becoming a better... We check our progress if we're always concerned about, am I going to be a better human being? It becomes very personal. And we think one can get really deluded by thinking along those lines.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. But we all do it. We all do it. We personalize everything. And in fact, it's not personal. We're just gaining control of this vehicle. And it doesn't want to give it up, that which we've trained to run the show. And we've given to them, to when you're here, when you're there, they come out, this part of our personality comes out, or this part of, or comes out. You know, we have a little bit for everybody. But we have to just give it up and be who we are, with all our bumps and warts and whatever else that we have, and be honest. Try to be honest and be in the moment, and try not to carry our luggage around with us. You know, put everything down. Let it go. And if we have any considerations, you do it at the end of the day. You say, okay, all right, and bye. And bye. Keep on moving on. Be free, but be honest. And one will slowly begin to incorporate into their life, into their consciousness, this awareness. You'll be aware why you're walking in the street, or you're doing the laundry, or you're, you know, our mind can take us wherever we want to go. We just have to train it where to go. There was a question here.
I was thinking that, you know, speaking of desire. it's not a self-serving thing. It's in the service of, when you become a better human being, you're actually, it's actually in the service of others. I mean, because it automatically, you know, you're helping others. I mean, you become, you know, so I think you get a pass on that as far as being a desirous, you know, because it's in the service of, you know, it's in the service of helping others. I think that, you know, that's my opinion. I think it's just different. You become a better human being, but, you know, it's great for everybody around you.
But better is a relative term. If you look at yourself in a non-judgmental way and just look at yourself and evaluate yourself honestly, and that you in the darkness of your soul, you know who you are. You know you love and you're kind and you be that. You don't be, you're not that you're a better human. No, you're trying to be a human being. You're just trying to be a human being. And compassion and love and tolerance and patience, these are all human qualities. And we become more human by nurturing these virtues, because it makes us more in harmony with each other. And those are spiritual qualities. You know, rising above the pairs of opposite. What is that? That's a point of view. You've elevated yourself. But how long can we stay in that elevated state? We just take whatever we can get, whenever we can get it. We get a glimpse every once in a while. You can sort of drop all your feelings and just sort of get a flash of the reality of the situation.
Well, instead, perhaps, of looking at me to see if I'm being a better human being, I can instead look towards someone I admire. What are their qualities that I would like to cultivate? And we can use the Buddha's idea on speech. Be kind, be honest, be compassionate, I think it's not just truthful, but don't say unnecessary things.
Yeah. Well, if we can surround ourselves with people who are kind and compassionate, we are truly blessed. You know, again, we live in a world of critics. We live in a world of fault finding. We live in a world where we talk about our shortcomings. But they're not important. It has no meaning. Only the meaning that we give it or our attachment to it. We need to talk about our attachment to ideas and to our actions. How can we become unattached to an action? Yeah, we act because of some reason. Have we ever considered the reasons? Have we ever considered if we didn't have that reason, would we have still acted? So we begin to see how we create the universe in which we live in. For every cause, there's an effect. Every cause, there's an effect. And don't think that those fleeting thoughts do not have their effect. That unguarded moment where we think ill of someone, and then we meet them and we say something and go, where did that come from? Well, it was that fleeting thought that we were attached to in some way. So we need to be in guard against all of that, our human frailties.
If the desire to become a human being, or any other desire for that matter, can be interpreted as a crutch or an attachment, a crutch or an attachment,
yeah,
which isn't productive, so to speak, then why are we here?
Well,
what is the purpose? If any purpose is interpreted as an attachment,
well,
why are we here?
The attachment is only on the personal plane. You know, we're only talking about this plane? You know, there's other planes of existence, and there is no attachment. There is only harmony. Everything is attached that way. You know, but any kind of desire to want something is an attachment. You have to give it up. You have to give up all attachments, even to wanting to be a better person. You just have to be. We're in this land of beingness, or being. We're in space. We're immersed in space. It's all around us. It's everywhere. And if we're not in it, space still exists. But if we're in it, it still exists as well. And one other thing that as a perfected human being, or perfectible human being, is that there's matter here and there's spirit here. How do they come together? How do they meet? Well, there's a very ancient term. It's called fohat. But in reality, on our consciousness, it's mind. A mind is that bridge between matter and spirit. That's why these ideas are so powerful. In the back? Different state of consciousness. And there are many states of consciousness. We know one or two, but maybe we know more, but we haven't been able to identify them as anything. But, you know, we enter different states of consciousness. That observer, observing everything that's going on, that's a state of consciousness. That's a deep meditative state. But the reason to meditate is to bring that meditation back into daily life so that we can be observers while we are integrating or becoming part of everyone else. Yes.
There was a thinker. He was he was a priest. His name was Giordano Bruno, and he operated in the late 1500s. And he taught all over France, Italy, England, these doctrines, the doctrines of the monad, the doctrine of everything being alive, of infinite universes, of every atom, every speck is a mirror. And he was put to death by the Inquisition. Actually, what they used to do is they would turn him over to the state authorities, and they would put them to death, and they'd say, "Lord, have mercy on his soul." And they would just wash their hands of him. But it's interesting because 400 years later, in the year 2000, the Pope apologized for that. But he made a statement that he was still an irredeemable heretic. So, in other words, he still thinks he's banished to hell. He's just sorry we burnt you. The point is that the church cannot reconcile to that. It's like they can't. They can't admit it, that he's right.
Well, what do you think would happen if they did?
They disappear.
Yeah, and they know that they are holding on to a rigid form of power. And, they are doing a immoral crime by putting these ideas out as a religion, as something for someone to follow, where they become enmeshed in darkness and separateness, because that's what it creates, separateness. So that the church or those who follow the dictates of it, you know, you proselytize and you tell someone else how to believe or what is true. You know, it's a heavy karma that will have to be paid.
But it can only be called immoral if the one who is pushing it forward knows better. If they are truly ignorant about the reality of life, then, well, let's call them ignorant, but not immoral.
Well, we have to consider how it all began. You know, why was it done? Why was the records altered? And why were certain ideas banished? It was a conscious effort. Now, truly, there are the many that just follow the dictates of the church and have no idea why. They just being good Catholics. But then again, there we go. We give up our responsibility to someone else. And we can't do that. We are held responsible. And the more we become engaged in the battle, the more we begin to fight, you know, the more we need to be on guard. Yes.
When teaching or presenting the concepts of theosophy to a new student, how do you convey to them that it's different from the concepts of Christianity or Judaism? Or, in other words, how do you tell them that this is not some dogma? That this is actually a true, absolute truth that you spoke of earlier?
Well, it really becomes difficult when, with all our heart and good motives, we want to tell somebody what this is all about. Because it's so meaningful to us. But that's part of the journey. How to be real with those around us and not be proselytizing, not be saying that we have the answer, that this is the truth. Well, it's our truth because we've come to realize certain ideas as to being inherent truths. And there's no two ways of getting around it. So I would like to tell you what I know, but that's tough. There's all kinds of ways, using your personality, to weasel your way into someone's brainwave. Tell them a joke. Say, gee, I know you from somewhere? Oh, yeah, I knew you from 1543. And then that'll start a conversation. Then they'll tell you you're a liar. Well, I made it up, but not a liar. Oh, yes, right here.
Most of the time, it's not so much teaching as it is taking the subject and displaying it and allowing the person to examine it according to what they believe. The idea of teaching somebody is like you're giving or you're showing. You're merely displaying what it is that you're speaking of and allow them to judge it next to what it is they believe.
Yeah, well, that's probably the most logical way of doing it. It's in our conversation. And even something that's said, you could express it in a theosophical way. And you know, but our real focus is to generate a conversation. But theosophy isn't for the mentally lazy. You have to get engaged. And if you engage somebody, sometimes that's the biggest hurdle. Yes?
We found if you're entering a conversation with someone who, you know, is actually first thing we always do is like, well, I'll tell you what we're talking about, what the way I see it, but don't believe it because I said it. I'm just going to give you some ideas, take it or leave it, and start with, you know, do you think you're an immortal soul? And is that different from the physical body? And if the answer is yes, then ask them, does immortal mean from the day you were conceived forward, or does it mean back and forward? And if they accept, you know, before birth and after birth, then it's one simple further step and say, so then if we're immortal souls and these bodies are temporary, can you accept the idea that we'll use this body, put it down, and use another body for experience and reincarnation? And if they're not willing to accept tentatively the idea that that goes on, let it go. Move into universal brotherhood, we're all one family, and give it to them. If they're not willing to even consider that,
well,
don't try to get beat.
Well, I think our responsibility is fellow human beings on this journey is to be a theosophist, but that's a living power in our life. We don't have to quote ideas and things that are taught in theosophy, and we don't have to do that. We have to be a real human being and being compassionate, listening to them talking. Just listen, having patience. Yes, and then little by little, you can interject a wider view of what they are looking at. And that's all it is. It's a wider view. Because what happens to us? We get caught in the moment, and that's all we can see. You can see this one problem, we can't see anything else. So it's oftentimes a wider point of view. Oh, yeah, okay. That sometimes relieves some of the mental suffering. Yes?
Well, it's like separating the wheat from the chaff. But no matter what religion background we have, these teachings help us separate the real from the unreal. Mm-hmm. That which confuses us about secular or state religions. Theosophy helps us to sift the chaff away.
Yes, that's a very good analogy.
Right, and we were going to mention military service is the same thing. 20, 30, 40 years ago, you had to do time in the military before you even got into your profession. And oh boy, the second chapter sounds mighty like it, because by the time they get through with you, you lose that chip on the shoulder attitude. You really lose it. And sex has nothing to do with it, because we knew that they were called waves and wax. So it's not a sexual thing. It's a moral and behavioristic thing. We listen to the young people today who consider themselves independent men or independent women.
Yeah.
Spend a little time in the military, they changed that attitude.
Well, we are all glad that you went in the military and we didn't have to. Okay? So we will learn from your analogies all these points of suffering that you went through. Okay? I have really no time left. Go ahead. It's a small one. Go.
It's a small one. It's probably the best way to approach this that we ever heard, and it's a phrase. Thus have I heard versus thus I know. So if we say we know something, we put ourselves in a certain attitude. Thus I have heard, offering an idea allows the other to take it.
Yes. It takes the personal out of it. Well, we hope you found these ideas to be stimulating and to awaken your curiosity. But we'd also like to remind you that this building stays open. These ideas are kept before the public through voluntary contributions of time, service, and money. All are welcome to participate in what we do here. You can present at the book table. You can leave a note in the donation box. But if you wish to serve in any way, you are welcome. Meeting adjourned. The turkey girl's back, huh?
Those are her glasses.
Oh, yes, yes.